Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here to speak about long cycles in supercritical random graphs. So I want to begin by telling you what these things mean in my title, and I think I'll go in reverse order. I'll tell you what I mean when I talk about random graphs and then supercritical random graphs, and then I'll describe this problem of finding long cycles in supercritical random graphs. There are different models that people use when they're talking about random graphs. Here's one model called the uniform model. I'm going to define a probability space, GN, and for combinatorialists like me, a probability space is just a set of objects and a probability on each one. Here my objects are just all of the labeled graphs on n vertices, and the distribution will just be the uniform distribution. So every graph is equally likely in this probability space. And then we're going to ask questions. What happens when you take a graph at random out of this probability space? What does it look like? What are its properties? So since we have a probability space, we can use all of the language and the tools that people in probability have given us. We can define random variables. We can define events. And we're going to be interested in events that have high probability for n approaching infinity. So I'm interested in very large graphs, asking about what events or what properties are true for large graphs. And there's an abbreviation, AAS, that you'll see. It means asymptotically almost surely. So if I say, for instance, let AN be the set of all the Hamiltonian graphs on n vertices. This is a property of graphs. It's also an event of our probability space. It is a fact that the probability of a random graph being Hamiltonian approaches 1 as n approaches infinity. So we say this event AN occurs AAS, asymptotically almost surely. Or if we're being more informal, I can just say that almost all graphs have a Hamilton cycle. So I've told you what I mean when I say random graph. I've explained this simple uniform model of random graphs. And now I want to tell you a couple of reasons why people want to study random graphs. One of the reasons actually is just that a random graph in some sense tells us something about a typical graph that is chosen at random. That sounds like an obvious thing to say, but there are applications where people are generating graphs and they want to know, okay, on average, what are the properties going to be? And it's useful to these people to know, oh, there's a Hamilton cycle with high probability. So that's reason number one. Here's the second reason. This is now stepping outside the realm of probability in random graphs. Let's go back to regular graph theory, where somebody is asking me the question, is there a graph G that has this special property Q? Well, if I can prove to you that the probability of having Q is positive, then there must be some graph in that probability space that has that property. So the answer is yes, if I can prove that the probability of a random graph having that property is positive. This is frustrating to some people because it's a non-constructive proof that there is a graph with this property, but there are theorems that have been proved this way for which there is no non-constructive proof. Here's another type of existence theorem. Does there exist a graph with no subgraphs isomorphic to H? Let's say. And here's a way of attacking that problem using random graphs. Maybe I can work out the expected number of copies of H that appear in a random graph. And if I'm really lucky, this expected number turns out to be less than 1. Okay, well, every graph in the probability space has an integer number of copies of H. And I've worked out this expected value. It's less than 1. So there must be some graph in that probability space that had zero copies of H. So again, the answer is yes, and my friends from constructive mathematics will be very frustrated with this, but again, this is a way that is used for proving some theorems. So random graphs can be used to prove things in other areas of graph theory and mathematics. I'm also learning to appreciate the interplay between random graphs and algorithms. And this, there's a symbiosis here that works in both directions. So perhaps we want to understand something about random graphs. One way of approaching this is to design an algorithm and figure out the behavior of the algorithm on this random graph. For instance, Fenner and Fries wrote down an algorithm that finds a Hamilton cycle in a random graph asymptotically almost surely. So a conclusion from that is the fact that I wrote on the first page. A random graph has a Hamilton cycle asymptotically almost surely. So algorithms can be used to prove theorems about random graphs. But also, we can work in the other direction. Sometimes people have an algorithm and they want to understand how does this work on average. Now, normally in undergraduate computer science, you're taught about the worst case behavior. You have an algorithm and you want to know, oh, how much time could it take no matter what input they chose. That's not the kind of question I'm asking. I'm asking, well, let's not worry about those strange worst cases. Let's just ask, how does this algorithm behave on average? In other words, that's a random variable. What is the time that this algorithm will take on an input from this distribution of graphs? So that is a question about random graphs that often can be answered with the theory of random graphs. So that's another reason why people study random graphs, this connection with algorithms. Now, I've mentioned Hamilton cycles a couple of times in this uniform model of random graphs. If you pick out a graph at random, you end up with something that has a Hamilton cycle. In fact, more is true. You end up with something, asymptotically almost surely, that's non-planar. These random graphs have a lot of edges in them, and so for some applications, they're really not suitable. So another model that has been developed is the probability space of all the n-vertex graphs that have a certain number of edges. So maybe these graphs that I was talking about earlier, maybe they have too many edges for the application you're trying to model. Maybe you're interested in sparse graphs. So we can let m be a function. Typically it will grow with n, the number of vertices, and define gnm to be the probability space of all the graphs that have exactly m edges and n vertices. And again, the probability distribution is just uniform here. And then we can ask questions. Okay, as n approaches infinity, what sort of things happen with high probability? And again, we'll use this phrase asymptotically almost surely, AAS. So m, then, I've told you, can be this function that describes the number of edges. We get to choose this function. And of course, when m is small, we expect there to be few edges in our graph, so the graph will probably just have a few edges in the graph, so there'll be lots and lots of tiny little components. And when m is large, like when m is large, getting towards m choose 2, we expect there to be larger components and fewer of them. Now, we can then ask a question about what happens if you view m increasing continuously from 0 to n choose 2. This is called the evolution of a random graph, and it's an area that's been well studied, and I think it has some surprising results in there. When I first heard about this, I thought that, well, if you're adding more edges, then many of these properties, like the number of components, should just kind of change gradually. But it turns out this doesn't happen gradually. Here's an example. When m is smaller than n over 2, then there are lots of small components. But as soon as m exceeds n over 2, suddenly there's one very large component called the giant component, and the others are quite small. So this change takes place very suddenly at this function n over 2. Now, people in physics are interested in modeling these types of changes. So here we're thinking about our n vertices as n objects. Our m edges are connections between these objects, maybe the interactions between particles in a gas, for instance. And then physicists might say there's some kind of phase transition going on when the number of edges is this special number m over 2. And that analogy I understand it from everyday life as the phase transition between solid and liquid. If you think about the water in this bottle at 20 degrees, it's a bunch of little molecules that are banging around. And then if you cool it down from 20 towards 0, well, it still looks pretty much the same until you reach 0, and then suddenly everything changes, and then you get ice, which I'm representing in this picture here. So that's the analogy I keep in my head for phase transition. And now, because this is an important number of edges, an important question, researchers want to know what's going on in the neighborhood of n over 2. So they've defined the critical period, or the critical phase, as the phase when the number of edges is a little bit more or a little bit less than n over 2. So something strange happens at n over 2. Let's widen the window a bit and try to figure out what's happening a bit before and after. In my title, I mentioned the supercritical phase, and that's when m is slightly more than n over 2. And that is the area that I'm going to be interested in. To make this more precise, if we let m, the number of edges, be a constant times n, then when the constant is less than 1/2, the largest component has size about ln n. When the constant is exactly 1/2, the largest component has size proportional to n to the 2/3. And then as soon as the constant exceeds 1/2, the largest component has a size that's linear in the number of vertices. So this is sometimes called the double jump in random graph literature. And this makes precise what I was saying about the number of, the largest component size changing dramatically at that point. And the question then I want to ask is, what is the length of the longest cycle when this constant is slightly greater than 1/2? Pardon me, that's not correct. I want to ask about the longest cycle when m is n over 2 plus a function that I mentioned on the previous sheet is not quite as big as n. So I'm interested in n over 2 plus s. I should be more precise. S is between n to the 2/3 and n. So that's not represented on this picture. I'm looking at a more refined time in the evolution. So we've got random graphs on m edges. Supercritical random graphs have this special number of edges, and the largest component has just become this giant component. And I want to ask about the longest cycle. The longest cycle. One of the ways to get at this problem is to define something called the core of a graph. And this is just based on the observation. Well, for my purposes, it's based on the observation that vertices of degree 1, or vertices that are just at the edges or part of a tree hanging off the side of a graph, can't be part of a cycle. So let me be more precise. The core of a graph is the maximal subgraph of minimum degree 2. And in the way I think of this is the stuff that can show up in a cycle in your graph. So we want to look for a long cycle in our random graph. And we know that in this supercritical phase, there's a giant component, and I've told you that any cycle has to be in the core of the graph. So a natural place to look for a long cycle is within our giant component, within the core. And this is what Thomas Woodchuck did in 1991. He looked at the core of the largest component of this random graph, and he made this really surprising discovery. If you look at this core, it's not all that random at all. It has this really beautiful structure. It's like a random three-regular graph represented with these big black dots where the edges have been subdivided with vertices of degree 2. So asymptotically, almost surely, all of the vertices lie in this kind of a formation. In fact, he proved that almost all of the vertices have degree 2, and these degree 2 vertices have a nice distribution on these edges. So I think about these, the long red lines between the black dots, I think of them as strands of beads or something like that. We want to find the length of a longest cycle, and most of the vertices have degree 2. So let's just count the vertices of degree 2, the beads that appear on these red strings. Well, fortunately, quite a bit is known about random regular graphs. I told you we could find a three regular graph with subdivided edges inside this core of the giant component. Random regular graphs are defined in a similar way to the other types of random graphs we've been talking about. We just have a probability space of all of the graphs on n vertices, and these graphs are all d regular. Typically, we think about d as a fixed constant, and for our application, d is 3. The probability distribution, again, is just the uniform distribution. So here are a couple of things that are known about these random regular graphs. The distribution of the short cycles is known, and it's just a Poisson random variable, and we can write down the mean. And something that we're going to use is this special fact here. If you take a random d-regular graph, then it has a Hamilton cycle, asymptotically almost surely. And this was proved about 10 years ago by Robinson and Wormald. So can you think about how this Hamilton cycle is going to be helpful to us? We have a big cubic graph with subdivided edges, and we know there's a Hamilton cycle in there, asymptotically almost surely. So this is the black and red is the picture from the previous page. This is the core of the giant component of the graph I want to understand. And by this theorem of Robinson and Wormald, asymptotically almost surely, we can pick out a Hamilton cycle, which I've drawn in green. Now, if we count the number of vertices on this Hamilton cycle, well, let's be sloppy and just count the degree 2 vertices. It's going to be because something is known about the distribution, I can tell you that it's going to be about 2/3 of the total number of degree 2 vertices in the graph. Why is that plausible? Certainly in a random, certainly in a three regular graph, if you have a Hamilton cycle, you're going to use 2/3 of the edges. And these degree 2 vertices are distributed pretty much uniformly. So this Hamilton cycle, one can prove that this Hamilton cycle has about 2/3 of the degree 2 edges, and that's where this lower bound comes from, 5.33 s squared n. So I see some puzzled faces. When I say Hamilton cycle, I just mean Hamilton cycle in the three regular graph formed by the big dots. I realize the green line is not a Hamilton cycle of the graph I've drawn. It's missing all of these vertices over here. So what I'm doing is I'm taking a Hamilton cycle in the big three regular graph, drawing it, and then noticing, hey, that gives us a long cycle in this original graph. So we've found a long cycle that has this particular length. This can be calculated. It's actually just 2/3 of the number of degree 2 vertices. So there exists a cycle of this length, asymptotically almost surely. So that's a lower bound on the question we were trying to solve. A lower bound on the question we were trying to solve. What about an upper bound? Well, in this same 1991 paper, Wuchok proved an upper bound that is the same order of magnitude, but a different constant there, you can see. So I'm going to explain quickly Wuchok's argument, and then I'll explain what I've done to improve that, to improve this upper bound. Now, there are some details that I'm glossing over, but now we're looking for an upper bound. We want to know how big could a long cycle possibly be? And it turns out that it's enough, again, just to look in the core of the giant component and figure out how long a cycle we could find there. And again, because it has this nice structure with the three regular graphs with the degree 2 vertices, it really becomes a problem of figuring out what kind of a cycle we're going to take in the three regular graphs. And think about the three regular graphs as having weights on the edges. So the weight on the edge would just be the number of degree 2 vertices that are sitting there. Weight of 2 here, weight of 5 here. So Wuchok's idea was that on each of these strings of beads, there's a certain number of degree 2 vertices. Write down all those numbers. We know that any cycle passing through all of these can only go through 2/3 of these long strings. Only go through 2/3. So take the largest 2/3 of these numbers. In this example here, turns out to be 17. And in general, because we know the distribution of these numbers, we can use this to get an upper bound. So if you have time, you can try to find the longest cycle in this little example. You'll see that we can't really achieve something that has 17 degree 2 vertices, because then we'd have to take three of these strings that have 5 beads each, and they are these three strings up here in the corner. And you can't have a cycle that passes through the same vertex. You can't have a cycle that meets the same vertex at three edges. So that observation that I just made is what led me to be able to improve this bound a little bit. So the observation is this. The longest cycle has to miss one of the strands at each of these big black vertices. The longest cycle cannot pass through these three long strands here. It can only pass through two of those. So at each of these big black vertices, I'm going to write down the length of the shortest neighbor. So here the shortest neighbor has 5, here 2, 2, and 2. So I can use this to calculate a maximum possible value for the total of the longest cycle. And that's just by taking these weights of all the edges and subtracting off these minimum weights, the amount that I have to miss everywhere. And because I've double counted things, I have to take off a half. So for this example, remember Wuchok's number, his upper bound was 17. I get 15.5. Has anyone counted how many vertices of degree 2 you can get in a long cycle? I think it's 14. Here, so it's not perfect, and in general, I don't think my bound is tight, but it is a little bit better than Wuchok's bound, and I think it suggests that there's more work that needs to be done here. So again, we have this gap between Wuchok's lower bound and his upper bound, and what I've done is just lowered this upper bound by analyzing more carefully what can happen in such a random graph. So this is a new idea leading to a new bound for the longest cycle in this supercritical random graph, but I believe that we should be able to make lots of additional improvements. And if you come back to next year's conference, hopefully I can tell you all about it. Thank you very much.